This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 20th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show with me, David Pleasant. In this episode of the show, I'll be meeting Seattle-based architect Jim Olson as he develops his niche for creating architecture for art.
Architecture and nature are both part of the same composition. And, art, the landscape, the architecture, everything, it's all one flowing statement.
And then our fashion director meets two women who have joined forces to create a new label that turned heads in Paris and beyond this year.
Mixing high-low culture and the kind of rakish aristocrat with the youth culture and the street culture of England.
Plus, we meet one of Japanese retail giants Muji's most trusted designers, Naoto Fukuzawa, and meet Gianluigi Recuperati from Milan's Domus Academy. All that coming up and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, to start the show, we delve into the world of architecture, or more precisely, architecture for art. Last week saw London in the midst of something of an art frenzy. Frieze, the UK's largest contemporary and fine arts fair, took place. Not what you might think to be an essential research trip for an architect. Well, it is if you're Jim Olson, founding partner of Seattle-based practice Olson Kundig. Prominent in much of his now-famed house designs is the creation of the right kind of spaces and atmospheres to display art, both old and new. Hence his passion for the world's art fairs. I sat down with Jim and discussed designing the perfect house for the aspiring art collector, as well as Jim's own house in Puget Sound, Washington State, which features in the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes, published by Gestalten and out now.
I'm pretty much just as interested in art as I am in architecture. And when I was a kid, I thought of becoming an artist, and it kind of morphed into architecture. So I essentially just took my love of art into the world of architecture. And I think I actually think more like an artist. And when I'm doing a house or a building, I think of it almost like a painting, I think, more than sculpture. In any case, just the love of art has sort of taken me into the art world, and I've gotten to know lots of artists and collaborated with them, and the same with art collectors and all. So my architecture is really about either weaving art into the architecture in a collaborative way or taking the collection and actually designing a building around the collection. So the architecture kind of extends the idea of a frame for the paintings or sculptures, and it really is there to serve and kind of work for the art and help people focus on it and understand it and enjoy it more.
And I'm interested in sort of your architect's or your artistic eye when you're meeting artists, looking at their collection, looking at their work, trying to appreciate what they're doing. Are you thinking architecturally at the same time? Are you thinking, okay, how can I frame this if it's something quite conceptual? Or is that how you're thinking? Are you thinking in sort of blueprints in your head around the art?
I think first I just go into the art itself and just lose myself in that. Then I think later on, I think more about how you might frame it or work with it. And some art is much better framed. And then other kinds of art kind of works into the architecture in a kind of contextual way where, I've done, say, for historic collections, you might do a background or a setting that actually takes you a little bit into the world where the art came from, but in a contemporary way with color and material and textures and things like that. And then other kinds of art, take a James Turrell light sculpture, it becomes really an atmosphere unto itself. And so in that case, the architecture just has to get out of the way and
you take the back seat as
an
architect.
Yeah, so sometimes the art is the environment, and other times the art is something to be specifically focused on. And in a lot of cases with us, the art and the architecture kind of weave back and forth. So they trade off as who's the star here and there.
And if we kind of broaden the discussion and look at your career and your CV, as it were, that there are other influences. And I think externally looking at your work, that there's an incredible sense of where your practice comes from, the region, that the Northwest of the United States. Is that still a big influence? Is it an organic style that is just present in your work? Or are you consciously trying to maintain that feeling of Washington State, of the alpine, the pine forests and so on?
I've always been an architect who, rather than building standalone buildings that are sort of look-at-me buildings, I tend to do buildings that weave themselves into the natural setting. And in the Northwest, we have, you know, lots of trees, and we have these very beautiful vertical trees. And so I weave horizontal lines to kind of play off of that. It's a lot like traditional Japanese architecture, where the architecture and nature are both part of the same composition. And actually, in traditional Japan, art was too. It's how I think. It's more like a Renaissance architect in that, you know, art, the landscape, the architecture, everything, it's all one flowing statement.
And are you taking the back seat as the architect to incorporate the landscape? We featured your own house in our Monocle Guide to the
That's
Cozy
right.
Home. And it's striking how you incorporate the landscape. And that was a gradual process. You weren't commissioning yourself and having to build it in 6 months, were you?
No, I started when I was 18 years old in 1959. And even then, I was starting in architecture school. The idea was to save all the trees on the site. So there was a tree that actually hugged the side of the house, actually three trees on three different sides of this little cabin. And for some reason, I've always felt that I should just be part of the environment rather than create a standalone kind of thing. And I don't really think of it as necessarily taking a back seat. I think of it as just being part of a bigger whole. The other thing is the architect really is a little bit like an orchestra conductor, where you have all these different aspects and, you know, people, craftsmen, artists, landscape architects, and you're working with all these things. But what I need to do is see the big picture of the whole environment and what needs to be done. And I kind of wrap it together. So it's a quiet way of becoming a leader as opposed to forcing myself out in front of everyone.
Do you find yourself with clients and the type of projects that you work on tend to go towards the larger, some people might call it flashier home, that perhaps the temptation there is to perhaps fall victim to that sort of big, iconoclastic, big sort of architecture that perhaps it goes against your philosophy as an architect?
Well, so far I've managed not to have that happen. Art collectors are an interesting group of people, and of course, they're all different. There's a certain sense of their identity that's all wrapped up in their collection or the art they're, you know, creating. And I've been able to let them have their identity with their collection and with their art as opposed to the architecture. It just works better for me. And the architecture is quietly strong, and so I'm always really proud of it. I just don't like it sort of taking the thing over. I think a lot of architects try to create architecture as an art piece. And in those cases, it can be really difficult then to put art in it because the architecture is competing as one of the pieces. And to me, it's there for a different reason.
You were telling me that you were at Frieze Masters, the side of Frieze that's becoming more and more popular with older pieces of art. Was there anything that really inspired you this time? Were you thinking, wow, that's something that I'd like to have in a house that I design?
You know, it's really interesting because I love very contemporary conceptual art and I love ancient Egyptian little sculptures. What I loved about Frieze Masters is that there's this amazing combination of ancient pieces with modern pieces and big, small, you know, bright and quiet and all that. And so I could imagine taking little bits and pieces through the various galleries in that show and putting them all together in one house or one small museum and somehow creating spaces that were appropriate to each one. I thought that was just great. I did also just love some of the mid-century and, you know, 1920s, 30s, and 40s furniture. I love some of those lines and the beautiful, rich materials, wood, you know, leathers, and beautiful craftsmanship. I thought that was great.
That was me speaking to Seattle-based architect Jim Olson, who was here at Midori House last week. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. He's famed for his simple but thoughtful product design. From a renowned wall-hanging CD player back in 1999, to chairs and even women's shoes. As well as working closely with Muji, which is set to open a Fifth Avenue flagship in November, Naoto Fukuzawa also works with a range of brands from around the world. Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, spoke to him in Midtown on a recent visit to the Big Apple.
Once I design something, particular category of items, I focus what is the iconic piece, what is the iconic shape of the object. If I focus women's shoes, for example, so what is the kind of image of the shoes? Everybody really feel immediately, oh, this is a shoe. And I'm not really trying to design it. I'm really trying to find something core. I try to find something particular of form or image which everybody already share. So it's already exists in people's mind. But I just kind of a person who in charge of visualize or realize it too.
But you're obviously naturally drawn to technology, no?
Everyone immediately use computer or mobile phones or whatever. So the image of the technology is way ahead of the technology which realize it yet. So I think it's everyone know what kind of future is coming. I'm a designer, I'm not really engineer, but technology is already kind of integrated with design. It's not technology and design environment. It's all in one integrated thing.
But why are you interested, for example, why have you been interested in exploring, I don't know, mobile phones or CD players? What draws you to that integration of design and technology?
It's already almost 20 years ago or 15 years ago, I'm not sure. But when I designed the CD player, for example, there are common sense of the audio equipment, which we call the black stack. For example, bigger speakers and lots of the boxes. So that was a kind of common image. But if I focus the listening the music from the CD, for example, we might have some other interactive way to listening music during cooking the breakfast or maybe brushing the teeth or whatever. So then I found a wall mount CD player. It's a pull switch turning the CD like a ventilation fan. So that is a kind of a more honest interaction, but it's way different from the common audio system. So that is kind of the way I'm making more real. Then once everybody see my CD player, they found a new kind of experience. Oh, that is maybe the one of the answer, better than the old-fashioned kind of audio system. So I just give the people some idea to share.
Out of all the products you've designed, I guess, what are you most proud of?
Oh, CD player was one of the very iconic products for me to describe my design too. But I do a lot of furniture design, particularly for the European market. That is also quite good. One of the wooden chair, the Maruni, is a company called Maruni. That is a beautiful. So Monocle Studio also using that too. So.
Obviously, you've done lots of work with Muji. How do you feel that yourself and Muji are aligned in terms of design philosophy?
Muji is humble, and Muji is not the making the things. More kind of advice or more propose what is a richness. So it's a lifestyle product company, but they suggest the life level of the richness. It's not as a money. If we propose and then the people found the Muji, they really kind of discover their mind, oh, that is a kind of enough richness. So that is we call the Muji is enough. And then they don't need any more to find or reach any kind of other richness.
Tell me why you teach. Is it because you want to, I guess, pass on your knowledge to a new generation? What motivates you to teach?
People call design as making things, but that's not anymore. I think in the future, we are less designing the form or more design the relationship. But we need to discuss about that. We still need to design how we interact with those kind of the function. For example, when we design the air conditioner, for example, we have to design the huge white box. We have to think about which kind of a shape or square or rectangle or a soft shape or edges. But it's not anymore exists such a kind of things. Now, designers have to think about air or temperature or moistures. So that is more important than just making the object. So we need to think about who is going to design the air, who is going to be temperature. So we are more designing to focus the ambient. So ambient is a new word, very important. So we have to design everything, but invisible and intangible.
That was our New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker speaking to Japanese designer Naoto Fukuzawa. Coming up on the show, we hear from fresh British fashion duo Hilia Bartley as they showed Paris their new collections last month. And before that, Monocle's Georgina Godwin meets Gianluigi Recuperati of Milan's Domus Academy as he launches a new book. All that still to come on Section D with me, David Pleasant.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Last week, Monocle's Georgina Godwin spoke to Gianluigi Recuperati, who is the creative director of the Domus Academy in Milan, one of the world's most prestigious schools for the postgraduate study of design and fashion. He is also the cross-disciplinary curator of the cultural programme of the Milan Image Fair. Gianluigi's books have been published in several languages, and his impressive new offering is entitled 100 Global Minds. This celebrates the world's most distinguished cross-disciplinary thinkers, many of which are, of course, designers. Georgina began by discussing the Domus Academy, which we in fact featured on the show earlier this year.
Domus Academy is a postgraduate school that is involved in teaching architecture, design, fashion and art, and it was the brainchild of several postmodern heroes of design and the arts like Mendini, Gianfranco Ferré, Pierre Restany, and many people that were like involved in the postmodern design Italian movement. We have like 400 students every year. Like it's a 1 year hyper dense year of cross-disciplinary intellectual brainstorm. And we just launched something called Metaphysical Club, which is a sort of teaching counterpart of the 100 Mind project. Is basically a club of people that gathers up a couple of times a year in Milan and kind of reason up about the ideas that should drive the school.
Tell me about this 100 Global Minds project. How did it start?
It started as the idea of trying to make a book that would be a divulgative guide to contemporary culture, most adventurous heroes, or what John Brockman, who's one of the 100 Global Minds, would call maverick intellectuals. Basically, the idea was to find out 100 very interesting people that work in cross-disciplinary interstitial spaces. Because my strong belief is that truly interesting things now happen in the interstitial spaces between disciplines.
Now, at the beginning of the book, you go all the way back to 1933.
Yeah, I do, because I think that the introduction is called The World Has Become a Black Mountain College. 1933 is the year the Black Mountain College, a mythical school in the United States, was founded. And it lasted many decades very unevenly because it was a very avant-garde school in which many different people from all disciplines collapsed in a sort of very avant-garde kind of education. So I think that the Black Mountain College is a very good 20th century example for a 21st century state of mind that now is more massive. Because I think that the digital revolution basically prompted us to think in numbers, figures, and words in a sort of bundle-up situation that cannot be denied. And the native, digital native are like a perfect embodiment of this. And this is truly cross-disciplinary. So it's, I think that today the world has become a sort of a Black Mountain College extended due to this strange combination of what once would be called like eclecticism and that was regarded as a negative thing, especially in the academia, and now is not anymore like this. Also because it's not actually eclecticism, but it's endless curiosity.
Such a huge array of people, 100 people, but all very, very different in this book. Just tell me a couple of the highlights.
Well, I think that there are basically writers, architects, curators, like any kind of, because I wanted the range of disciplines to be as big as possible. And I think that one of the most beautiful joys in producing this book was to curate the quotes that I, because every page is basically made up of an illustration of a sort of a cross-disciplinary figurative counterpart, like a graphic design that is a sort of Rorschach-like blur of colors. That is a beautiful idea of the graphic designers, Connor and David, who I thank. And then there is a description of a sort of dry description of the work of the person. And then a quote. And the quote is very important because it's very difficult to pick up a quote from people that are writing very interesting things. And it obviously gives a very peculiar angle view of their work. Mm. But nevertheless, it's important. I choose two. One is an astronomer, Dimitar Sasselov. He's a wonderful and very accomplished astronomer, but at the same time, he's a very good prose writer and he's wrote some of the most interesting and most well-written books in science. And the phrase that I chose is one of the most beautiful in the entire book. Is he says that universe and life compare with each other as a father and child, which is a beautiful way of summing up something that is very interesting. And then there's another that I would love to quote, which is, I think, is from Alison Gopnik, a great psychologist writer. She says that what's it like to be a baby, to be in the mind of a baby? It's like being in love for the first time in Paris in your life after you had the 3 double espresso.
That was Georgina Godwin speaking to Gianluigi Recuperati on his new book, 100 Global Minds, which is out now. This is Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, to end the show, we look back and cross the channel to Paris in September. The city was awash with fashion designers, journalists and buyers. Amongst them was our very own fashion director, Daphne Azard, taking in all the sights and sounds of Paris Fashion Week. Now, she tells me that the two women that we were about to hear from were her favourite finds from the season. Bringing together various very eclectic inspirations, former Mark by Marc Jacobs' Katie Hillier and Luella Bartley's new label revisits traditional British tailoring. Hillier Bartley's new line uses 32 styles in an attempt, in their words, to rework high and low fashion. Daphne caught up with them in Paris last month.
So we've started off quite small. It's something that Katie and I have kind of dreamed of doing for a long time. So this is our second season. The first season was very small and we're growing. So we've got the bags and the ready-to-wear and also some jewellery. And it's basically, it's everything that we love about kind of English culture, from traditional Savile Row to the kind of rock and roll element and then a kind of more street casual element. So we're kind of mixing high-low culture and, you know, the kind of rakish aristocrat with the kind of youth culture and the street culture of England, really.
How do you work together?
Luella and I have worked together for, we keep 15, 16 years, and I originally first started working with Luella as her design assistant. And then I ended up doing lots of other things. for you, with you.
Very quickly became an accessory designer.
And Luella and I worked together. We had a break for a little while Luella moved to Cornwall and
had some children. I moved to Cornwall on the south coast of England for a while just to kind of... I had three children very quickly, and so I needed a break.
Yeah.
What about you?
No, I did not have children.
Carried on working.
I carried on working. And always have worked with Luella in some capacity or another. And obviously we've been really good friends for a very long time through work. And a few years ago, when I was given the opportunity to be the creative director at Mark by Mark, I asked Luella to do it with me. But prior to that decision being made, Luella had made a decision to move back to London, and we'd already started talking about what we could do together. I'd already started working on handbags, or at least the idea of what handbags would look like for myself. And I got to a point where I felt that the handbag collection on its own, or launching a handbag collection on its own, really didn't have that much excitement to me for it to be just that standalone thing. And I wanted Luella to either work with me on the handbags. And then when we started first talking about that, it turned into, well, you know, why don't we just do the whole thing?
And who is the woman who can wear Hylia Bartley, you think?
I think it's very broad, actually. I think in the way that you have, you know, very different feelings coming into the collection, it can go from, you know, someone you were saying earlier that you saw Alexa in it, and she's, I don't know, 20, nearly 30, I think she's 30, actually. But I think that can go right up to, you know, Ruth, who owns Matches. I'm not quite sure how old she is, and I wouldn't want to say, but, you know, just older than Alexa, and she looked incredible in it. So I think it certainly started off for us as something that felt very relevant to us at 40 and becoming excited about growing up and sort of embracing it and tackling it and feeling empowered by getting older and wanting to feel more like a woman. So it is very womanly, but I think it's quite universal. I think old or young, it doesn't really matter. It's got an attitude to it, and I think it's more about that.
You decided to make a presentation more than a show. Can you explain this choice?
We don't want to do a show right now. You know, never say never, but it doesn't feel, for us, it doesn't feel very modern. And I think this collection feels a very modern version of us. And I really like showing people and talking about it and having them try it on and touch it and feel more of a connection with it than seeing someone who's, you know, quite unattainable marching down a catwalk. That's not what it's about. It's about making a woman feel good, not seeing a teenager on a catwalk. So I think it represents us and how we feel about fashion now.
That was our fashion director there, Daphne Hezard, speaking to fashion designers Katie Hylia and Luella Bartley, creators of new label Hylia Bartley at Paris Fashion Week in September. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, David Pleasant. We'll be back at the same time next week. If you've missed any of this week's show or for our back catalogue, you can go to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. This show was put together by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries or questions, you can contact me, the producer of the show, David Pleasant, at dmp@monocle.com. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.